Ready to get started again? We're on the verge of a major growth in the number of people who suffer from Alzheimer's. If the church is going to be involved in ministering to these people and their caregivers, those of us in the church need to understand what it is and what it does to a person. Every day, Alzheimer's disease robs millions of older Americans of their memories, their dreams, and their lives. Family members also suffer as they watch their loved ones change before their eyes. So, why does Mama do that? And I see some people here who have heard this before, so I hope it's not too boring to hear it again. But I have found over and over again that people who hear this come up to me and say, "Oh, I wish I'd known this before Daddy died," or "I wish I'd known this before Mama died. I was so angry because of the way they behaved." And so I think if we understand why the behaviors occur, then we can cope better with them and with taking care of our loved ones. So an introduction here. 14 million people in the U.S. will have Alzheimer's by the middle of the 21st century. One in 10 persons over age 65, one in 10 over 65, and nearly half over 85 will succumb to the disease. That means that if you're over 85, you're either suffering from Alzheimer's or you're helping to provide care. A person will live an average of 8 years and as many as 20 years once symptoms appear. The average lifetime cost of care for those with Alzheimer's is $174,000 per person. Most people with Alzheimer's receive Medicare benefits, and nearly half receive Medicaid. One in every five Medicare dollars, one in every five Medicare dollars is spent for the care of Alzheimer's sufferers. It's a lot of money. Seven in ten people with Alzheimer's live at home, with 75% of their care provided by family and friends. The average annual compensation paid to caregivers for care at home is $12,500. At least half of all nursing home patients have Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. And the average annual cost of care for those with Alzheimer's in nursing homes is $42,000. So if you're caring for a person at home and you're getting paid for it, you get paid $12,500. If they're in a nursing home, it's an annual cost of about $42,000 a year. So, history of Alzheimer's. First case in history was a lady that was named Augusta, and she was admitted to a medical asylum in 1901 by Dr. Alois Alzheimer, and she had no memory of any simple things and very bizarre behaviors. And so Dr. Alzheimer did an autopsy at her death, and that was the first time that the plaques and tangles were seen in the brain. In the 114 years since that discovery, we have no more to offer than we did in 1901. That is astounding. Of the top 10 causes of death worldwide, Alzheimer's disease is the only disease that can't be prevented, cured, or its progress slowed. So in the last 10 years, there's been more research being done than in all the years before it. But because people equate Alzheimer's disease with senility, they equate it with old age. And so why spend money on it? But it is a significant social financial issue. And so we do need to do something about it. It's very, very important that we do something about it, or we're going to spend a lot more money in this country on taking care of people with Alzheimer's disease. Now, why does it happen? So these are two pictures side by side of the normal brain of somebody who died at an old age and the brain of an Alzheimer's person. You can see the difference in the size. You can see the bigger holes in the one of the Alzheimer's brain, which means that tissue is lost. There's no neuro connections there. So here is a cross-section of the normal brain of a person who died. And here's the next one is a cross-section of a person with Alzheimer's disease. And you can see how much bigger the ventricles there are in the middle, how much wider the sulci are, and just the holes in the tissue. That is tissue that has been lost. So how does that affect the person? I'm going to look at the lobes of the brain and just get an idea of what each one does and what happens when there is malfunction in them. This is not an all-inclusive study. It's very, very brief. And if any of you have neuropsychological degrees, you can leave. Or, you know, or if you're a psychiatrist or something like that. I can't compete with that. So in the healthy brain, we're going to be looking at the hippocampus, the frontal lobe, the temporal lobe, the occipital lobe, and the parietal lobe. So we're talking about these different lobes of the brain, but we have to remember that the brain always functions as an integrated whole. So it's never just one area of the brain that we're talking about. How does this affect the whole brain if there's one area that isn't working correctly? So a single function like speech, for example, is handled by several different areas in the brain at the same time. So the first area we're going to look at is the hippocampus. Hippocampus are two seahorse-shaped areas in the base of the brain, and this is where short-term memory goes first. So it goes there first, and then it gets passed into long-term memory in other parts of the brain. And this tends to be the place where Alzheimer's disease starts. So I'm going to give you some examples to let you know how your hippocampus works, okay? So I'm going to give you a telephone number, and I want you to repeat it right back to me. 215-846-1041. Okay, here is an example of trying to do something that the brain isn't programmed to do. The hippocampus works in patterns of seven. So if you have seven numbers, you can remember them more easily. If you have 10 numbers, you don't remember them as easily. So 8461041, you can remember pretty quickly. That's the hippocampus at work. Okay, here's another test, and this is one that we give when somebody's admitted and we're doing tests to see if they have any issues with memory. And I'm going to give you three objects, and I want you to remember them. So apple, table, penny. Those are the three. Remember those. Now, I want you to count backwards by sevens.
Sorry,
now. Oh, from 100. Count backwards by sevens from 100. Okay, now spell the word world backwards. Okay, now what were the three objects I asked you to remember? Okay, how did you remember them? Okay, so you had a visual hint. Okay. Some people repeat them over and over again. Some people have a mnemonic that they say in order to remember it. But we all have ways of remembering things, and that's our hippocampus at work. So another function that is controlled by the hippocampus is the awareness of time. Without looking at your watches or a clock, if there's one that you can see, tell me what time it is. Okay, how do you know that? Okay, so we have an awareness of time. Now, if your hippocampus isn't working, you can't remember from 1 second to the next what you just had said to you. If you have no awareness of time, and you feel, how do you think you feel? Confused, anxious, overwhelmed, fearful. So, okay, this is the first place that Alzheimer's starts, in the brain, and these are the kinds of feelings that are evoked when it's not working correctly. So you have to deal with the person, and how do you do that? Well, first of all, you never make fun of them. You never say, oh, come on, I just said that. Can't you remember anything? My mother, I want to see my mother, and they're 94. You don't say, you're 94 years old. How old do you think your mother is? Are you stupid? You don't say things like that, but you know what? I've heard those kinds of things. A healthy hippocampus is necessary to orient a person to their world and to the changing events of the day. So people who suffer from Alzheimer's often feel frightened and unsafe. So the hippocampus records new information or short-term memory and sends it to other parts of the brain to be stored as long-term memory. Now, the next area that we're going to look at is the frontal lobe. Frontal lobe is responsible for alertness, concentration, personality, judgment, impulse control, and task sequencing. And when the frontal lobe is impaired, there's a loss of ability to understand the meaning of what is going on in the moment. And when that is associated with the hippocampus damage that's already occurred, you really have confusion. So your person can't make sense of the present time. So this is the person, you say that there's a Christmas tree and Christmas carols are playing, and you say to them, what month of the year is it? And they'll say August. They can't make sense of time. The person may not be able, because of poor judgment, to understand that they've soiled themselves and they smell bad and they need to take a shower. So they'll fight you because I don't smell bad. I don't need this. So that's part of the frontal lobe damage that's causing that. A person who's suffering from frontal lobe damage might use crude language, cursing, or yelling at others. There's no empathy or compassion because this part of the brain is impaired. So here's where we begin to see that there needs to be some understanding on the part of people in the church. I'm going to use Bruce's grandmother as an example of this, but Bruce's grandmother was a godly woman all her life, and she lived for the last 10 years of her life with mother and dad. And the last 2 years, I went out with my girls and spent 2 weeks each of those two summers so that mother and dad could get off on a vacation, which they couldn't do when they were taking care of her because they couldn't leave her at all. And I was cursed at. I was accused of killing her husband. I was accused of stealing her things. You know, she fought me when I tried to give her a bath. And here was this godly woman that I know in her right mind had never cursed in her life, had never taken the Lord's name in vain, and all of these things were happening. Well, what tends to happen when we see that, we make judgments. We say, that person couldn't possibly have been a Christian. A Christian wouldn't do that. But here we have a person whose brain is deteriorating, and so they are no longer able to do what they're supposed to do. And it's something that we need to take into consideration. This is the person who makes up stories to fill in the gaps that are missing. And they get accused of lying. But a lie is something that we do on purpose. We know what the truth is, and we say something different. This is something that's done to hold the individual's personality together. They can't remember what happened when they were married, where they were married, what they were wearing, whatever. And so they make up another picture. And the people that were with them, especially in our congregations where we know everybody and everything that happened to them their entire lives, we tend to say, well, they're lying. No, they're not lying. And we have to look at that differently. Have to treat it differently. Sequencing. I want you to think about what it takes to brush your teeth. You have to take the toothbrush, turn on the water, put the toothbrush under the water, open the cap on the toothpaste, put some on the toothbrush, brush your teeth, rinse the toothbrush, shake the water off, and put it back in the holder. Well, or spit. Oh, yes, I forgot spitting. My grandsons wouldn't have forgotten that. But anyway, just a simple thing like that takes a step-by-step sequencing, and the frontal lobe is responsible for that. So when there's impairment in the frontal lobe, then you get things being done that they can no longer maybe figure out that they have to pick up a fork, put some food on the fork, put the fork to their mouth in order to eat. They can no longer understand that they have to put their underwear on before they put their dress on. So they'll put the dress on and they'll put the underwear on over top of it. So that's sequencing, and that's something that the frontal lobe is responsible for. So the frontal lobe gives us our ability to concentrate, stay alert, and understand the meaning of ideas and statements. And when these abilities are impaired, then you get personality changes. And so the person, not all the time, but the person who might have been an easygoing person can become combative and angry, and all of these things that we were talking about. They can make changes in the personality because the frontal lobe is no longer working right. And one change that happens with the personality then is paranoia occurs. And paranoia is defined as systematized delusions of persecution or acting on suspicion of others. And so this person can no longer reason well. So they put the lady will put her purse down in her room, and then she can't remember where she put it. So instead of saying, oh, and going and looking for it because she knows that it's in there someplace, she'll accuse somebody of stealing it. And that happened on a daily basis sometimes with me. And how do you deal with that? Well, you want to distract them and maybe go in and search for the purse yourself or else ask them permission and search for it in front of them. But anyway, you don't want to get upset with them because they're accusing people of stealing, because that's just part of this disease process. So the overall effect of the hippocampus and frontal lobe impairment combined is the loss of the starter button. So the person is no longer able to decide what to do. So you'll sit them down at the table in front of a plate of food, and they'll just sit there and stare at it. And so then it's up to you to go and get the fork, put it in their hand, and start them eating. You have to be their starter button. They may not be able to just get up and go someplace, walk someplace, because they don't know how to start that activity anymore. So you have to be the starter button. You have to cue them. So in summary, the frontal lobe is that part of the brain which is responsible for alertness, concentration, impulse control, judgment, personality, and sequencing. Judgment is defined as the operation of the mind involving comparison and discrimination by which knowledge of values and relations is mentally formulated. And paranoia is the systematized delusions of persecution, suspiciousness. And that is what's going on when the frontal lobe is impaired in this terrible disease. The next part of the brain that we're going to look at is the temporal lobe. And the temporal lobe is responsible for our ability to speak and to understand language. So difficulties with orientation and problem solving are compounded when our cells are lost in the temporal lobe. And what happens is the person suffers from symptoms called aphasia. There are two types of aphasia. One is expressive aphasia, that's the ability to speak words. And then there's receptive aphasia, the ability to understand words. Expressive aphasia is what happens first with a person. They'll begin to not be able to say words. They won't make sense with what they say. Receptive aphasia tends to be something that is further down in the disease before it's lost. And so that's why you shouldn't talk about a person with Alzheimer's disease in front of them. If they're not able to talk to you, they still may be able to understand what you're saying. So you need to be careful what you say in front of them. So how do we test for that? Well, another of the many mental exam tests is to show a person a watch and say, "What is this?" Well, they might say, "This is a clock." Is that correct? No, it isn't. It's close, but it's not correct. And so how do you handle that? Well, you say, you just give them the word. You say, "Well, yes, that's a watch, and we tell time with it." But you might ask a person that you're testing, "What is this?" And they'll get mad because they can't come up with a word. They're embarrassed and they're humiliated, and so they'll get angry. So that tells you that you should back off from this. Just let it go. Don't embarrass them. It is frustration. So sometimes, due to this impairment in the temporal lobe, a person may have expressive aphasia, and so his speech will not make any sense. So he might say something like, let's see, where is it? "That is good, and you wear it, and it's up." What in the world does that mean? It makes no sense whatsoever. That's called word salad. So they're trying to say something. What's coming out is not what they're thinking. And so it's difficult to take care of a person when that's happening because it makes you frustrated. It makes you feel out of control. You tend to get irritated. Your body language shows that you're upset, and it just makes them more upset. And so you have to pay attention to their body language. What do you think they're trying to say? Are there any clues around in the environment that might tell you what they're trying to say? And if you're with them all the time and you know, for instance, what their toileting schedule is and it's past that, it may be that they're telling you that they need to go to the bathroom. So you have to pick up on clues, and then you have to watch your own body language and your tone of voice, so that you don't upset them more by the way that you respond to them. The next area is the occipital lobe. And the occipital lobe is the back of the brain. And together with the parietal lobe, it's involved with vision, the ability to see in a wide circle around us. So that I want you to put your hands like blinders next to your eyes and put your head down a little bit, and then see how that changes your feeling of how much you see in the environment. And that's what happens when those cells begin to die in the occipital lobe. It's like people have blinders on and they can't see. So if you come up behind that person and you start talking, they don't know who's talking. If you come up beside them and they can't see you, and they don't know what's going on, this is the time when they get agitated and they'll hit you because they can't see you. So when you're dealing with somebody that has impairment in the occipital lobe, you always get directly in front of them, eye-to-eye contact, so they can see your face, they can see your body language, and they don't tend to react as negatively then. It also gives them the ability to see things in three dimension. And so the person that has impairment here could be looking at the floor, and if there's a pattern in the rug, it may seem like that pattern is raised a little bit and they walk as though they're going to trip over it. Or if it's it may look like there's a dark circle there that they're going to fall into. And so they're careful of that. If you're taking care of somebody at home, the kinds of things you need to look out for is the pathway that they normally walk always clear? Do you always keep the furniture in the same place? Is there a dog in the home which could lie down and be a tripping hazard? If you're taking them outside and they don't have depth perception, they may trip and fall because they can't step down off a curb. So those are the kinds of things that you need to be aware of when you're talking about the occipital lobe. And then it also is the ability to process rapid movement. What is that in our environment? What is rapid movement mostly?
TV.
So when we want to rest with little kids, we put them in front of Sesame Street. When we want to rest from the parent that we're taking care of, we put them in front of the TV. And that's the worst thing you can do because they can't process rapid movement. And it can be very, very scary. I had one resident, we have a TV on the wall and a bunch of chairs in the hall. And the people were sitting there, and this lady, the news was on, and it was about a flood. And this lady just got immensely upset because she couldn't tell that this wasn't in this time and place. And it was just happening so quickly. She was just very, very upset. So you need to be aware of these kinds of things that happen with the occipital lobe. And then the parietal lobe, the part of the brain that makes sense of the senses. So we're talking about seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, and touching. And our brain is like a computer. So when you type on a keyboard of a computer, the electronic impulses go into the computer and are interpreted by a software program. If cells die in the parietal lobe, the brain will continue to send the messages, but the program isn't figuring out what it's saying. So it's just gibberish. And that condition is known as agnosia. And agnosia can be true of any one of the senses, or it could be more than one of the senses. So, for instance, the place where I've seen it happen the most is the person who's been regularly getting a shower once a week. You take them into the shower and suddenly they are screaming and yelling and fighting you because they no longer understand the feeling of the water hitting their skin, and it terrifies them. So you have to do something different at that point and say, okay, showers are out. What am I going to do for the care of this person now? So most of the time, all of the senses aren't involved. So you try to use the senses that aren't involved. For instance, if you combine vision with touch. So you put the person in front of a sink, put the water in the sink, and let the person see the water in the sink, and then put their hand into the water. That's using more than one of the senses, and you'll be able to bathe them that way, possibly. Some people will put their hands on both sides of the bathroom door and just absolutely refuse to go into the bathroom because they're afraid of the toilet. That's a vision thing. They may not be able to comprehend anymore what that is, and it scares them. So, you know, we don't like to talk about briefs, but there comes a point in time when you're going to have to put a brief on a person, and the only way that you can toilet them is by taking care of that. So it affects the way that you give care when parts of the brain are in trouble. So, abnormal behaviors. All of the abnormal behaviors that occur in a person with dementia can be explained by loss of cells in particular areas of the brain. A person with Alzheimer's disease or any other type of dementia will never get any better, only worse. This is not a situation of use it or lose it, and I've heard spouses say that to their partners, you know, if you just do this more often, you wouldn't forget. But it's not a use-it-or-lose-it situation. So if you as the caregiver can come to terms with this fact, of the stress of dealing with the stress of dealing with this situation will be lessened. So the next thing we're going to look at is the stages of Alzheimer's disease. And I want you to kind of, as we go through this, remember what we've learned about the brain and about losing cells in the brain. So first, the first stage of Alzheimer's disease is called the forgetfulness stage. It is 2 to 4 years leading up to and including the diagnosis. And in this early stage, the person may know something is wrong, yet be able to cover it up from others. And so this is the person who will start writing notes to themselves, putting them up by the telephone, so that they can remind themselves of things that they're forgetting. But they can maybe keep on going, and the family won't know it yet. Their symptoms, they cannot remember what he or she was just told to do. Confusion about places occurs, and so they get lost on the way to work. They lose spontaneity and the zest for life. Mood and personality changes occur, and the person becomes anxious about symptoms and avoids people. Poor judgment occurs, and they make bad decisions. I had one person who sold her house for a dollar, and the family had to go through all kinds of legal maneuvers to get that house back from the person that bought it for a dollar. It takes longer to do routine chores. Sequencing, they can't sequence as easily, so it takes them longer to do things. And they have trouble handling money and paying bills, and this oftentimes is the first clue to families that something's going wrong when bills aren't getting paid or checks are bouncing or something like that. Somebody needs to take over here. And examples of stage one, they lose things. They forget their grocery list. They arrive at the wrong place or time, and I've done that. Constantly rechecking the calendar. The family saying, Mother's not the same. She's withdrawn. She's disinterested. Or Mother spent all day making dinner, and then she forgot to serve several courses. She paid the same bill three times over, or she didn't pay them for 3 months. Those are the kinds of things that you're looking at. So stage one is the forgetfulness stage. The second stage is called the confusion stage. So it lasts for about 2 to 10 years after the diagnosis. And as the disease progresses, the person can no longer hide it from others. Alzheimer's disease patients in the middle stages become easily confused and cannot be left alone. So you have increasing memory loss and confusion. And this may be the longest stage. The first stage and the last stage may not last as long as this one does. So you may have the person in this second stage for longer than the other stages. There's a shorter attention span. So you'll sit down with your mother to show her pictures of her past or pictures of her grandchildren. And after about 3 minutes, she doesn't care anymore. Their attention span just isn't as long. They can't find the right words, and they make up stories to fill in the blanks. And we've kind of talked about that. I'm going back and forth between two slides here. There's problems recognizing close friends and or family. My mother always remembers me, but her grandchildren now, when they go in, she can't say their names, and they're not always sure she knows who they are, and she doesn't remember her great-grandchildren. So, you know, it's a progressive thing. There are repetitive statements and there are movements. The repetitive statements are just mind-bogglingly horrific. Because you have a person that all day long will sit there and say, help me, help me, help me. And it's very, very difficult to listen to that all day and not go out of your mind. They're restless, especially in the late afternoon and at night. And occasionally they have muscle twitches or jerking. So symptoms of this stage two, and think about the brain here. Perceptual motor problems. We just talked about the occipital and parietal area of the brains, and that's what's going on here. They can't find the right words, and they make up stories to fill in the blanks. Temporal lobe, where speech happens. Problems with reading, writing, and numbers. That's the frontal lobe and all of the things that happen there. They may be suspicious, irritable, fidgety, teary, or silly. Again, that's frontal lobe. Loss of impulse control. They're sloppy. They won't bathe, or they're afraid to bathe, and they have trouble dressing. They may gain and then lose weight. They may see or hear things that are not there. Those are called delusions. And they need full-time supervision. So you have to have 24. If they're in the home, they have to have 24/7 care. One person cannot do that. It's impossible. So if they're going to be cared at home, for at home, then you have to get outside help. Examples of the second stage, memory loss. They can't remember visits even though the visitor just left. And so the person will get very, very upset because they'll say, my husband never comes to visit me. Now, the husband had been there for 8 hours and it was time to go home, but they can't remember that. They have repetitive movements are statements, we've already said that. They sleep often, and it's usually not very long. So they'll sleep maybe for 20 minutes, and then they're awake. And this is frequently at night, they may get up and wander. They, because of the perceptual motor difficulties, they have trouble getting into a chair. They have trouble setting a meal on the table. They can't find the right words. They have problems with reading. They can't follow written signs or write their name or add or subtract. They may be very suspicious, so they may approve. They may accuse their spouse of hiding things. They may accuse the spouse of being unfaithful. They may act very childishly. And there's loss of impulse control, and so they have sloppier table manners. So the person who never, ever would have done such a thing in the past will take their teeth out, lay them on the table. When they're done, they'll kind of rub them and put them back in their mouth, and you have people sitting at the table with them. Or they may blow their nose with their napkin or something like that. They just don't have any impulse control anymore. They may undress at inappropriate times. And this is one of those times where if you don't laugh, you'll cry. Because you knew the person when they were with it. They would never, ever have done anything like that. But I remember one time when a pastor was preaching at the home, and a lady opened the doors in back of the pulpit without a stitch on and walked into the service. And so we were scrambling to find a blanket in a hurry to get over her. But it's that kind of thing. They just don't have any impulse. They might have been too hot, so they took off their clothes, or you know, something was uncomfortable. And then they may have a huge appetite for junk food and other people's food. They don't remember that they just ate. So after breakfast, they're accusing you of not feeding them because they don't remember that they ate. And they'll graze. So they'll go from table to table, and they'll pick up food from other people's plates and eat it. And I remember once when one of the residents was found to have been going, after everybody was out of the dining room, picking up the plates and licking them, and then putting them into the cupboard. And somebody just happened to see that happening, and so then we could take care of it. But I don't know how long it went on before that. So these things can be funny to think about, but they're not. The person would never have done that in their right mind. And then we're looking at the terminal stage, or the third stage. This is the dependent stage, and it lasts from 1 to 3 years. And in the final stages of the disease, Alzheimer's disease patients become quite disoriented, and it is the time of complete dependence on the caregiver. And oftentimes this is when they have to be placed in a facility, because 24/7 care, where you have to turn them and dress them and clean them and all of these things that just have to be done over and over again, is just too much. And so, my battery's running low. Okay. So, do you want to get my cord and plug it in? Is there a place to plug it in? Here it goes in here. I thought I had 6 hours of memory in this.
You did.
That's awesome. Yes, I know. You're perfectly... Okay. So, symptoms. You can't recognize family or themselves in the mirror. They don't recognize themselves anymore. They lose weight even with a good diet. When the brain is not functioning correctly and the brain doesn't do what it's supposed to do, then metabolism doesn't happen. Good metabolism doesn't happen. And so it doesn't matter if they're getting good food, they lose weight. They have little capacity for self-care. They can't communicate with words. They may put everything in their mouth or touch everything. They can't control bowels or bladder. What does this sound like?
A baby.
And they may have seizures, experience difficulty swallowing, and skin infections. So they may look in the mirror and talk to their own image. They need help with all of the activities of daily living. They may groan, scream, or make grunting noises. Remember, there was a lady that was a PhD in nursing, had written several textbooks, and she screamed all the time. That's the only communication she could make. And it was just so sad because I'd known her when she was at the top of her game. They may groan, scream, or make grunting noises. They may try to suck on everything, and they sleep more. So, does God care? That's the question. Does God care? And there are some verses here that I want to share with you that have helped me and have given to families. Psalm 103, 13 and 14. As a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. For he knows how we are formed. He remembers that we are dust. What can dust do? If you see those dust balls under the bed, unless a gust of wind comes along and moves it, it can't do anything on its own. So God knows that we are just dust. And then John 6, 37 through 40. All that the Father gives me shall come to me, and the one who comes to me I will certainly not cast out. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And this is the will of him who sent me, that of all that he has given me I lose nothing, but raise it up on the last day. And one more here. John 10, 28 through 30. And I give eternal life to them, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. So I think that there's a problem in those of us, for those of us that have been Christians and been given the gift of living in a Christian family from the day we're born, to begin to think that our ability to perform is part of our salvation. We would never say that out loud, but I think we can feel that way. And so then, when the brain starts to disintegrate and we can no longer do what's right, we can no longer keep ourselves from swearing and using God's name in vain, we can no longer remember those closest to us, and that includes God sometimes. We can't remember what simple objects are. We can't read the Bible for ourselves anymore. All of these things that we've done all our lives that tell us that we're good Christians. When we can't do those things anymore, we have to remember that our salvation is in Christ alone. We don't do anything to earn our salvation. And if God has given us salvation, it can't be taken away. And the families especially need to know that and to be reminded of that over and over again as they watch their loved ones deteriorate. So, the end. You can, yes.
Thank you for that.
It's on.
I was wondering, because many drugs that we take, especially for pain, cause some of these same symptoms you're talking about with, you know, sensory problems, word finding, which, you know, can be the beginnings of an aphasia. You know, you just can't remember those words. You know what you want, but it's not coming.
That's also normal aging.
Well, no, I'm talking about over and above that. That happens like right after your meds are upped, and you have the sensory problems, depending on what your illness is. A lot of neuropathy with diabetes, for example, or without diabetes. Anyway, my question is, these drug-induced symptoms, I'm going to say drug-induced, do they lead to more of these brain changes or not?
No, I would say no. And it's important to understand that there are many symptoms of other diseases that mimic these. And so in order for it to be diagnosed, you can't make a complete diagnosis of Alzheimer's until you've died and an autopsy is done and you see these plaques and tangles in the brain. But 90 to 95% of the time, you can make the diagnosis based on scans, CAT scans, PET scans of the brain, which shows if the brain has decreased in size. Mm-hmm. You can do testing. I think it was 1997. I applied for a mini fellowship at the Alzheimer's Disease Research Council, and it was a week of every day going and following one family over the whole week of testing that gets done. So there's a lot of testing. There's complete physical. They do all kinds of blood tests. They look at everything else that it might possibly be. You have a neuropsychiatrist involved that gives all of these tests that test the different parts of the brain. You have social workers and nurses. Everybody that's involved in the care is there. And then after a week, they get all the results of these back, and they call the family back in, and they sit down, and they give them the results of the testing. A lot of times, diseases like thyroid conditions will cause many of these symptoms. Many of the drugs will cause the symptoms, but if they're removed, the symptoms go away. So, they don't make a snap decision based on just what they're observing that this is Alzheimer's disease. There has to be a very careful diagnosis process.
I was just concerned that, persons who have these symptoms that many times are drug-induced from different drugs who do different things to you, blurred vision and, just all kinds of stuff, that we be sensitive to that and try not to judge that person has Alzheimer's.
Yes, that's a good thing to do.
Because a person who has a lot of these issues going on could look like they're in stage one, mm-hmm, because of
side effects,
sensory loss and vision loss and, all kinds of word finding. It's so many things that might look like first stage. Mm-hmm. I'm having word finding problems right now. So anyway, I think it's an issue of trying to, we need to know that person better.
Well, it's encourage them to go be diagnosed.
But I mean, as a church, I'm sorry.
As a church,
we need to at knowing what's really going on with that person before we judge what's going on with that person.
Yeah, and this is why we're commanded not to judge. Oftentimes, a person in the first stage will stop coming to church. Mm-hmm. And since church is such an important part of our lives, our tendency sometimes is to judge them and say, well, why aren't they being good Christians? Why aren't they coming to church anymore? And it may be that they're pulling back because the stimulation is too much. They are experiencing some of these symptoms, and it's an embarrassment because they can't answer the questions that people ask them. So it is very important to be non-judgmental. That I agree with that. You had a question back there.
I know that the medical community does not have too many answers about this, But what is the current thinking or theories as to the causes?
There are so many theories, it's almost impossible to name them all.
Okay, then what is the prevailing theory?
Yeah. There isn't a prevailing one.
Okay.
They've tried all kinds of things. One of the things that they're doing now is there are four drugs that are used that don't cure it, don't prevent it, but may slow the process down somewhat. And what they're doing with those drugs now is giving them to people at a younger age. And it's to the people that have a familial type of Alzheimer's disease. So there are two different kinds. One is familial, the other is called idiopathic. They don't know what the cause of it is. But with the familial one, the people can start to suffer symptoms in the 30-year decade. And so they are beginning to try giving those drugs at a much earlier point in time to see if that does impact the disease with these people. And then probably in the last 10 years, they are doing more research worldwide, trying to find new drugs. They see these tangles and plaques in the brain, but they don't know if that's a result of the disease or if it's cause of the disease, because when they're seeing them is at autopsy. So, you know, they're trying to figure out, okay, is it the chicken or the egg? They don't know. And you see on the internet, you see all kinds of things being said, oh, a cure has been found. No, there hasn't been. And it's like we have no more to offer than we did in 1901. So Alzheimer's disease kills as many people annually as cancer. But the amount of money going into cancer research is enormously greater than the amount of money going into Alzheimer's disease. But Alzheimer's disease, socially, financially, is a huge issue, and it is going to become a much greater issue. So we really do need, in the medical community, to spend more money on research to see if there's anything that can slow it down or if we can find what the reason is. But right now, they've tried all kinds. Oh, vitamin E, take high doses of vitamin E, that'll take care of it. Or, you know, if you use these brain exercises, none of that has proven to be true. I get every year a report from Johns Hopkins on Alzheimer's disease, and just every year, you know, there are new things that are being tried, but nothing yet has. The familial type is very hereditary. I mean, if you have that familial type that starts very early, 50% of the people in the family will have it, will get it. 50%. And so then they have to decide, do I want to be tested to see if I have the particular gene that carries this? Because they do know what gene carries it in that type of Alzheimer's disease. Some people want to know, and some people don't want to know.
How does one differentiate between just normal dementia and Alzheimer's
disease? Well, dementia is the umbrella term. So there are many different diseases with dementia. There's a dementia that's called small vessel disease. So this is the person that gets little teeny tiny hemorrhages in the brain, and it ends up causing blood not to go to some of the cells. And so over a period of time, you begin to have symptoms of dementia. One of the things that's different is it doesn't have the – with Alzheimer's, it's a downward spiral. Nothing stops it, and it doesn't plateau. So you won't have a person that – has the symptoms for a while, and then for one or two or three years maybe doesn't get any worse. Doesn't get any better, but doesn't get any worse. There's a dementia, type of dementia that goes along with Parkinson's disease called Lewy body dementia. And the symptoms with that are a little bit different. There's a disease called Pick's disease that just affects the frontal lobe of the brain. So there are a number of diseases that come under this umbrella of dementia. 85% of people with dementia have Alzheimer's. 85% have Alzheimer's. So it's by far the largest contingent of people that have dementia.
Uh, Jonathan?
Trying to think which question is a priority. You had a number of statistics at various times. Is there any like easy go-to place you go to for the statistics or that?
Alzheimer's Association.
Okay.
Just alzheimersassociation.com.
Mm-hmm.
They have, it's wonderful the amount of information they have. It's overwhelming the amount of information they have.
I was wondering about, I picked up on how you're saying kids, a lot of times the symptoms can be the same as looking at young kids. Is it basically an issue of kids' brains have not developed in some ways to learn these things, whereas older people,
their brains are disintegrating.
Has that been sort of shown, you think or?
I think when you think about an infant that sucks on everything because the tongue, the mouth is the most sensitive part of the body, and that's how they get understanding of the world around them. But that understanding is going up, whereas the older people with dementia, they're beginning to suck things because the brain is disintegrated and they can't feel anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a downward spiral.
And on the prevention side, you're saying it really can't be prevented. Have studies been tried to see, like to follow people who might do certain memory exercises or certain like little tasks and stuff? And I mean, I'm thinking you have to have a study where some they follow people who do that, they follow people who don't do that, and the outcomes as far as Alzheimer's, there's no significant difference. Okay. Okay.
It can't hurt to do them.
Yeah,
it helps your brain in the general sense, but it doesn't stop the disease.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't prevent the disease.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, it makes your brain more active. I mean, they're good, but they don't prevent Alzheimer's.
And then one more thing along the way. One of the things you mentioned was the, I forget which stage, one of the first stages was the, you said the toothbrush example of sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm imagining it would probably get to the point where this wouldn't help, but does it help as an interim thing to maybe, I'm thinking again with kids, like to put a chart, 1, 2, 3, does that help at that point, or is even the sense of following a 1, 2, 3 would not?
At first it might help, but you've got a lot of things going on there. You've got the ability to understand words. The ability to read.
Right.
I mean, it's more than just...
making the process more complicated.
Yeah, the process, it's not just an easy thing. But we do put notes up for people to remember, especially in the first stage.
First stage, yes,
it's a good thing to do in the first stage. Mm-hmm. And people will do that themselves. Have any of you seen the movie Still Alice? If you have not seen that movie, see that movie. It is the most realistic picture of the beginning of Alzheimer's disease and how it impacts the person's life that I've seen. There's no romanticism about it. It's very good. Julianne Moore she got an Oscar for it. It came out last year and it's very good.
Hmm.
So
Still Alice?
Still Alice.
Okay.
So even though she was suffering from this, you know, she was trying to say, I'm still Alice. I'm still in here. Yeah, it was a very good movie.
One last thing from me was, could you share any stories of witnessing to people, either people with Alzheimer's early or later, or to caregivers? Just like spiritual care and maybe witnessing people that don't know the Lord through the experience, whoever you think.
I think that those verses I shared at the end there are the ones that I've shared the most with family, whether I knew they were Christians or not. You know, the question, does God care? Does God care about this suffering? And so then that leads to questions if they're not Christians. it's a comfort if they are Christians, but it leads to questions if they're not Christians. People with especially end of second stage into third stage, you've kind of lost the window of opportunity for them to understand. So the witnessing needs to be done before that. You know, that's why it's never good to wait. Because there comes a point when they can't understand. And I know of people who have been missionaries who have loved the Lord tremendously and brought other people to Christ, who get to the place where they're terrified that they're going to hell. And they, you know, they cry and scream about that, and you really can't comfort them. They just can't understand it. They can't. And they become delusional, and so this is a delusion that they have, and you can't reason them out of it. So this is a terrible, terrible, terrible disease. It is.
Question related to that, because I've known people who are like that who are younger, low metal, and some health issue, and so you have usually therapy, counseling, and
drugs
to help them.
Not at that stage.
Anyway?
Not at the third stage of.
Okay, what about the second stage?
Part of the disease process is depression and anxiety. That's part of what happens when those cells are lost in the brain, and drugs are given to help with that, the depression and the anxiety. And I want to wring people's necks. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say this. It's being taped, isn't it? Christians often will deny their family members the use of antidepressants or anti-anxiety drugs because it's not a Christian thing to do. But it is a symptomatic relief. And when the anxiety is so great that it's just overwhelming them, sometimes these medications can help take the edge off. And sometimes they use antipsychotic drugs to control the behaviors of people that are suffering from these diseases or from Alzheimer's. And it's not the thing you want to do, but if you have somebody that is really, really combative and is beating up the staff, and, you know, the staff takes a lot of beating, taking care of, and so do family members. They get hit and scratched and pinched and you name it. They get abused. And sometimes these antipsychotic drugs will help with those symptoms. And we try not to give them any longer than necessary because as the disease progresses, they'll pass through that combative stage and they don't need the drug anymore. But if you are ever talking to somebody, don't deny the person that ability to be calmer because of the anxiety and the depression. That's part of the disease. That's a physiologic response to those cells being lost in the brain.
Try to dissuade them from what's going on. I know you don't argue because it's not going to change, but how can you help comfort someone in that situation and help them to adjust to that sort of situation?
Do you turn the lights off at night?
No, there's a light on at night.
All the time. That's one thing. That's one thing that you might want brighter than a night light. One thing that they found is that as the day gets longer, the shadows get longer, people get more anxious. It's called sundowning. And they found that if they keep the lights on, that that isn't as much of a problem if there's not that change in lighting. Sometimes you can't comfort, sometimes you can't. Nothing you do or say will change. They just can't be reasoned with. And you can't argue. You shouldn't say no. You know, have you ever tried not saying no? Don't do that. But you shouldn't. You really shouldn't. You shouldn't argue. You shouldn't disagree, because they won't be able to change their minds. And as they perceive your anxiety and your intention to make them change their minds, they become more and more anxious and combative. So, you know, it's really, it becomes an issue of how do I train myself to watch what my body language is saying? What a large percentage of our communication is body language. Not the words we're speaking, but the way our body conveys what we mean. So if you're saying something very nice, but your fists are like this, the person is going to pick up on this, not your words. So it's very hard for the caregivers. Very hard. I don't have any magic.
Margaret, I really appreciate the scripture passages that you gave as far as really being comfort to those who are, you know, dealing with people who are in the terminal stages. And one verse that I have found that has been wonderful is Philippians 1:6. And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion in the day of Christ Jesus.
You have my pen. Can you write that down?
Philippians 1:6 is marvelous. It's just been, and then in Romans, the 8th chapter, you know, Paul is speaking about who's going to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus, you know. And it says nothing can do that. That wonderful eternal security and the perseverance of the saints, the persevering of God.
Persevering of God.
And then that passage in John, the 10th chapter, where Jesus say, I and my Father are one. I think of the imagery of here, you know, Jesus saying, I and my Father are one. We've got you, you know. We're going to keep you secure. You know. And so these are just some comments on that. And thank you.
I would like to just provide an affirmation for you. I'm one of those that heard this presentation. This is my third time. And I wish I could hear it at least monthly, because things within my life, within my mother's life, keep changing, and I hear something from you each time that I glossed over previously and I now need. Friday, my mother and I were out, and an 18-wheeler passed her, and she just, you could see her tense up and said, oh, that scares me so. And I was dismissing it. And thanks to what you've said this morning, I trust, I pray that I will deal better with that next time.
Thank you.
We plan on putting this on the internet. So if you've left your email address here, you can listen to it once a month or as often as you like.
There you go. Well, thank you. I like doing it. Except I don't like the preparation. I mean, I need to say a week before I'm going to do it, yes, I'll do it, rather than 3 months before I do it. Because it's just always on my mind, yes. Yeah. No, I've been amazed at thinking about Bruce and preparing sermons every week. And having it ready to go every week. And I've heard many of his sermons over again, but he never has exactly the same sermon. So I'm hoping that, you know, as I give this and I read more material, that it's a little bit different every time. But essentially, it's the same. But it is something that I'm passionate about. I think people need to know this if they're going to minister in as congregations. If we're going to minister to people that are suffering from this, or the people that are caring for them, we need to know this.
our congregation now has a program to help, like pregnant women and people who are sick with dinners and so on. But we don't have anything for long-term, to help people with long-term disability, the caregivers and so on. Any suggestions about developing that kind of program?
Well, what did you do to develop the program for pregnant women or... No, that's true. But you have to have people that are interested in doing it, first of all. You can't put this on people that don't have any interest. And God gifts us differently. So I would say start with asking for people that are interested in helping with this kind of a situation. And then brainstorming. If I was in that situation, what would I need? Maybe having somebody bring in a meal every week, that's a big commitment. So it shouldn't be the same person every week, but, it means self-sacrifice. It means self-sacrifice. There's no getting around that. And I know from experience that it's easy to complain. When you get to doing it and you think you're doing it too much, you get to complain, which is not what pleases God. So I think that it just needs to be thought of as something that needs an organizational... You don't do it if you don't have a plan. That's one thing about the nursing process that carries over into all areas of life. You have a plan. So you do an assessment. You plan, you implement, you evaluate, you reassess, and it just goes in a circle. And that process can be used almost in any situation in life. But I think it would be good to bring it up in the congregation and say, here's something that we've been made aware of and we think would be a good thing. Is there anybody that's interested in getting together to meet and talk about this? And a lot of people have ideas that they haven't shared because they've experienced things. So, you have, both of you are in this congregation, Elaine and Marilyn. And then almost every day I saw you at the home. You came to see your mother so frequently, and that was a real time-consuming thing. At the end of the day, often when you're dead tired from working, that's commitment, and that's what it takes. It takes commitment.
Extremely helpful. I speak for myself and I think for everyone else. And it's obvious that you are very dedicated and very passionate about it. So thank you very much, Margie.
You're welcome.
And as I said, we're going to be uploading this when our technical people can take care of it to get it on these two sessions on the internet. We might even be able to get the outlines on PDF files to go along with it. So for those of you who have left your email here, we can notify you when that time comes. Hopefully that won't be too far into the future. Thanks again for spending your Saturday morning here, and I'm sure it was a productive one. Have a good day and be safe.